Assalamu alaikum, everyone. My name is Adina Lekovich, and I am here on behalf of the Islamic Center of Southern California, welcoming you to the second session of a four-part series called Hidden Figures, Tracing the History of Muslim Women Scholars. It is wonderful to be back with you all this Sunday. Hopefully many of you joined us last week when we kicked off the series with our guest, Dr. Gail Kinnard, who shared a lot of wonderful insight about the wives of the Prophet, peace be upon him, as the earliest vision of scholars of Islam that we have, as one of their sacred duties was to learn and recite the verses of the Quran and to teach them to others. And today we continue the conversation. So I begin with Assalamu alaikum, in case I forgot to say it earlier, may peace be upon you. And I also begin with Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, most compassionate, most merciful. This is already the highlight of my week, and I'm excited to be back with you all to be joined by our guest, Dr. Asma Saeed. Today we will pick up where we left off. If you were not with us last week, don't worry. This is each of these sessions can serve as standalone bites, and overall they provide a fuller picture if taken together. But you are right where you were supposed to be if you were just joining us today for the first time. And if you want to catch up on what you missed, you can watch the video on the Islamic Center's Facebook page. The videos are going up right afterwards. That's the Facebook Live version of this. And you are all welcome to participate in the comments and to ask your questions start to end. This series is inspired by the ethos of the Islamic Center of Southern California, which is fostering a relationship with Islam and a relationship with our Creator that is highly personal, that is a conversation that is intimate, and that is empowered through religious literacy. That's not official language of the center, but that's what keeps me connected to the Islamic Center and the work that I do with the Islamic Center. And that's hopefully what this series will also reflect. I'm going to start with some of the same introductions I gave last time just to bring people up to speed, but I'm going to talk for a shorter period of time today so we can spend more time with our guest. This series is for those of you who are thirsty for more history about Muslim women, and I'm really excited to share with you all that that the thirst is growing. Last week, I reported to you we had about 150 people on the class registration list, and as of now, there's 230 people on the class registration list, and it's growing every day, and that's really exciting to see. And I also want to share with you that when I went back and looked at the comments from last week, and I asked those of you who are outside of Los Angeles to share with us where you're tuning in from, we had people join us from Australia and England and Canada and within our own country, as far as Tennessee and New York. And that was just for the people who self-identified. So if you're in the chat now, I invite you to share where you are tuning in from so that we get a sense of how far-reaching this little community of ours is becoming, and we welcome all of you. Let's see, what else? I want to say again that this series is a space for spiritual seekers who mostly call ourselves Muslim. And it's a place for us to learn more about our history so that we can empower ourselves and empower the people around us, inside of our families and outside of them. And looking at the class registration list last night, I was curious to see how many of those registered are men versus women, just stereotypically off of the names that I read. With that bias in mind, or that blind spot in mind, I'm proud of the 12% of the class registrants who are men, who appear to be men by your names, who are with us. And I hope that we get more and more, especially on the official class list. I know plenty of other people will be tuning in other ways. If you would like to get reminders about this class, please do sign up on our, if you go to eventbrite.com and you put in Hidden Figures, Muslim Women Scholars, you'll find this event. Believe me, there's not any others going on that I know of. And then you'll be officially on the class list. And you'll also get joined to the Islamic Center of Southern California's newsletter in the process, which you can always opt out on. I want to also make that clear. And I point out that this 12% of men who are officially registered with us, because I want to underscore the core statistic that I shared last week about the place of women in the overall specter of history, meaning the stories that are told about people since the beginning of time. And according to historians, about 0.5% of recorded history tells women's stories. So we are operating in a landscape that that we are just part of, rather than being an exception to a landscape. And so the information that we seek here and the insights we seek here are to bring forward the little history that is available about Muslim women, especially in this regard, and to also be very comfortable in saying, in questioning sources and thinking and asking hard questions about you know, all of the issues that are brought up, and about being able to simultaneously hold our 2020 minds, and also the 7th century, and 7th century Arabia time and everything that has come between then and now, and the place of women throughout all of that history. So that's the backdrop that we operate from. And today we have Dr. Asma Saeed with us. I mentioned last week was Gail Kinnard. Next week, today we're going to be talking about hadith transmission or religious knowledge transmission by women from the early days of Islam all the way until the Ottoman Empire, which is a staggering period of 10 centuries, of the first 10 centuries of Islam that we'll cover today. And next week we'll follow that up with Angelica Lindsay Ali, who will join us to be talking about West African Muslim women scholars. And last week she was not confirmed. She is now confirmed. I'm excited to have her next week. And then we will have our last session with Dr. Asma Barlas, who is the author of Believing Women in Islam, Unreading Patriarchal Interpretations of the Quran, which is a fantastic book. And she will be offering her insights from her book, as well as an analysis of contemporary Muslim women scholars, and really ground us in what's going on today, because we have certainly a period of flourishing that is taking place for a variety of reasons. Lastly, I wanna say that there may be a few changes along the way. In doing my research, I have realized that we have a gap in our understanding of Shia women scholars. And so I am looking into bringing in another voice somewhere in order to fill in the picture. This is certainly not going to be complete. It's a 4-week series. We're getting tastes of things, but I want to name that and also say that I'm working on it. And then we're also going to have a bonus session with Dr. Amina Wadood, who was originally part of this series. And since she and I talked and I realized that her specialization is truly in Quran and gender, we decided to do a separate session, recorded session with her, that we will then air and share it after this series is complete. So I hope all of that makes sense. There's a lot of rich content coming up, and I hope you stay with us throughout that. Before I introduce Dr. Asma, I want to say something about our community. This is a community where we are inviting speakers in to share their deep knowledge in these areas with their research and their experience and their insights. And they represent themselves in this space. This is a space for open dialogue. It's about creating a forum and inviting speakers to discuss. And as always, the views of each speaker are their own and are made available for you to ponder on. And they're not the official position of the Islamic Center of Southern California. Everybody has the right to speak as themselves. So, in addition to that, all opinions are welcome here on the chat and in your questions. That is, except those that are misogynistic or disrespectful to our speakers. If I see any loaded questions, I'll try to reword them so that they are not loaded questions, to give you the benefit of the doubt. But this is an open forum, and you use it with a good heart and an open mind, inshallah. And lastly, I ask that you type your questions in all caps in the chat, so that they stand out. Comments and other things tend to be in regular font, but if you want your question to stand out as I'm scanning through the chat, please put it in all caps. This is your one-time permission to use all caps. And I think that is everything I have to say. Let me look quickly at the chat to see where people are joining from, because it looks like folks have said, oh, we have somebody from Panama. We have somebody from Chicago. Our friends from Sydney, Australia are back. Portland, Oregon, shout out to Portland, Oregon with all that's going on there with the Black Lives Matter demonstrations that are going on. Reno, Nevada, Santa Maria, California, Austin, Texas, Portsmouth, that looks like the UK flag, Seattle. I'm seeing a lot of different people. So welcome all of you who are with us. And we are now up to about 65 participants who are here with us today. So welcome, and welcome to you, Dr. Asma Saeed. We are so excited to have you join us, and you are all the way across town on the other side of Los Angeles today, aren't you?
Absolutely. Sort of. I'm in Thousand Oaks, so it seems like many, many miles away.
Mm-hmm. All the way on the other side of Los Angeles. Those of you who know how far that can feel. Thank you for joining us today. I'm so excited to talk to you and learn from you about the place of women in the transmission of religious knowledge primarily through the medium of Hadith, and how this has ebbed and flowed repeatedly over the course of the first 10 centuries of Sunni Islam. I'm already astounded at what you're going to be able to share in just a short period of time, considering it's so much history. And so let me just read just a sentence about Dr. Saeed so that everyone knows who you are. Dr. Saeed is an assistant professor of Islamic studies at UCLA in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures. And her primary research interests are in early and classical Muslim social history, the intersections of law and social history, gender, and the history of Muslim education, all topics that are relevant to the conversation that we're going to have here today. So welcome, Dr. Saeed. And could you start by just telling us a little bit? I'm always interested in people's stories. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what drew you to your field of study, and particularly the study of Muslim women in education?
Yes, absolutely. So I want to start actually with Assalamu Alaikum to everybody. And thank you, especially Adina and the Islamic Center of Southern California, for inviting me here. It's a wonderful forum and an opportunity for me to share my work with a much broader audience. So thank you very much. And I look forward to what I hope will be a good conversation afterwards. Now, with respect to my own background, I am the director of the Islamic Studies program at UCLA currently. And I imagine that there are some of you who might be high school students or college students in the audience, or I hope there are, who are excited or eager to learn about Islamic history. And I have to say that when I was in college, I never envisioned myself as a historian. When I had the opportunity to do a senior thesis at college, I was very excited about what was going on with Muslim communities around me at the time. I grew up in New York City. I saw some of the wonderful social activism that people were engaged with in Brooklyn, New York. And so I actually did sort of a anthropological, sociological type of senior thesis on social activism and African-American Muslims in Brooklyn, New York. So very different from where I wound up. And how I wound up here is that, you know, like many of you, I was very interested in the position of women in Islam. And at one point in, I think, maybe a Friday khutbah, or just a speech addressed to a general audience in a masjid, I heard something about female jurists, Muslim women who are knowledgeable about Islamic law. And I thought, that's really interesting. I want to know more. And I wanted to know more from the classical Arabic sources. I had studied them. I had studied Arabic a little bit in college. And so I started in the 20th century with a work actually that was written in the 20th century. For some of you who might know Islamic history of classical Arabic sources, it's Omar Rida Kahala's A'lam al-Nisa. It's a 5-volume work. It's just devoted to Muslim women across space and time. And I was really fascinated because in this 5-volume work, there were hundreds of women who were known for their knowledge of Islamic law. And I thought, this is great. I'm going to go study this. I'm going to, you know, maybe do a master's, maybe do a PhD. And but the right way to do a PhD in Islamic history is to work backwards in time. So I started with this 20th century source, and I thought, I got to go to the earlier sources and see what's there. And what happened to the narrative was very interesting for me. As I went farther and farther back in time, what I noticed was that the women who in the 20th century were celebrated as jurists, as knowledgeable about Islamic law, that wasn't how the earlier sources described them, right? So there was something interesting, something unusual going on there. And the other thing I noticed was that the earlier sources were just full of hadith transmitters, female hadith transmitters. And I thought, I had never heard of female hadith transmitters, and there are hundreds of them, thousands of them here. I want to study this. I want to know what this is. I want to know what they were doing. I want to know what their lives were like. And so, I mean, that's kind of how I got where I am, or where I was a few years ago with my research. I've actually moved on to other things now. But and that brings me to what I want to talk about today, which is tracing the history of these female hadith transmitters in very, very broad brush strokes, because as Adina mentioned, and I cover 10 centuries in my book, and I'm not going to get into that in any kind of detail here, but I'll start with very broad brush strokes.
You're welcome. I forgot to mention the book that I've consumed voraciously.
Thank you. I actually have, that reminded me that I have a PowerPoint slide, and that's my first slide on the PowerPoint. So I wonder if I could just maybe share my screen.
Sure. As you do that, I want to encourage people to, as Dr. Saeed is speaking, if you have questions, to go ahead and put them in the, again, in the chat box, preferably in all caps. And we'll come to the questions after she shares, which will be 20, 25 minutes or so. And then we'll open it up to Q&A with all of you. I'll pepper in my own questions. And so that's, the format that we have. So it's all yours.
Great, thank you. And hopefully you can now see my screen with the cover of my book. All right, great. Anyhow, as I was saying, what I'd like to do is just spend the first few minutes sketching this very broad history, talking about some of the highlights, as it were, some of what I noticed in chronological patterns, and then I want to get together examine a case study from Mamluk Syria, 15th, 16th century Syria. So last week, you all heard about the wives of the Prophet Muhammad and his female companions. And we all know that, in Muslim communities the world over throughout history, right, we consider the Prophet and his community to be exemplary, right? And we think, okay, if the wives of the Prophet, if the female companions were doing something, we can expect that women in subsequent generations would do the same thing, and that if it's a good thing, a beneficial thing, that they will continue, and that phenomenon will kind of grow and multiply. And that's actually not what we see happening. What our historical records show is something very, very different. So we know that the wife of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, Aisha bint Abi Bakr, radiallahu anha, that she and other female companions and a few successors were really they were very active in the domain of hadith transmission and what we call religion. But if you look at the decades after them, right? I mean, you'll see, sorry, just to step back, the female companions are regularly referenced as sources of knowledge with respect to hadith. And there are 112 of them who are who contribute to the hadith corpus, the Sunni hadith corpus. But in the generations afterwards, starting sort of around the time of the successors and for about a century and a half afterwards, there's an incredibly sharp drop in the numbers of women who are considered trustworthy hadith transmitters. So in the 9th century, for example, women just completely disappear from the record altogether. I mean, it's very hard to find women who are transmitting hadith in the 9th century. And in my book, I examine in much more detail the reasons for this breaking chronology, the reasons women drop out of the record altogether. But just to summarize here, what's happening in the 8th and 9th century is what I call the professionalization of different spheres of religious learning. So there are new standards that are being introduced, basically new hurdles that people have to cross or jump over to be considered religious scholars in these domains, like tafsir or law or hadith or theology. So when we're talking about hadith transmission, the best scholars are the ones who demonstrate what we can call legal acumen. That is, they understand what a text means, a hadith text means with respect to its grammar, the morphology of the Arabic language with respect to the application of the hadith. They're also the ones who could say, I learned this hadith directly from the scholar who's teaching it, or the best scholar, or somebody who's a reliable authority. And you know, keep in mind, again, when we're talking about the 9th century, we're talking about a time when obviously there's no remote learning capacity, right? And the best scholars are the ones who take really long, rigorous journeys. Often these journeys are, you know, you take it by yourself. You don't have a company with you. It's not in a group. And they took these long solitary journeys to collect hadith. These journeys are sometimes known as the Rihla fi Talab al-Hadith. And these journeys went on all over the Muslim world and across time as well. So women could not compete in this environment. The hurdles were a bit too high for them to continue the pace of activity that they had managed to establish during the era of the companions and the early successors. Now, what's interesting for me as I looked at this historical record is I thought, okay, well, that's it. They disappear in the 9th century and they're gone. We should not expect their participation in later centuries. And that's just not the case. The decline in the participation of women is not permanent. In the 10th century, there's this extraordinary reemergence of women in this domain. And what we see is in cities like Nishapur and Merv and Isfahan, later on in Cairo, Damascus, Baghdad, what starts off as sort of a trickle, let's say, just a few women in a few cities who are learning hadith again, who are starting to be acknowledged as authorities in hadith transmission. And over the centuries, these numbers very steadily increase. And by the 15th century, you have a biographical dictionary. It's, I think, a 10 or 12 volume dictionary called Daw al-Lama, written by an Egyptian scholar, Sakhawi. And he has, within this multi-volume work, an entire volume devoted just to women. So over 1,000 entries that are devoted to women who are known for their piety and their religious learning. So this revival of women in hadith transmission was diffuse. I mean, that is, it happened across the Muslim world, and it spanned almost four centuries. And then something interesting happens again around the 15th and the 16th century, women fall out of the picture again, or we see a diminishing in the rates of female participation in hadith transmission. This happens around the early Ottoman period, and this has to do with other shifts in patterns of religious learning and what was valued. Hadith, it is said, was valued less in the early Ottoman era, and this is perhaps one reason why women in hadith transmission kind of fall off a bit. But the phenomenon continues, and it continues to the modern day. So when I was in Morocco doing field work on a very different project a few years ago, I had the honor and pleasure of meeting Sheikha Bahia in Morocco, and she passed away just a few years ago, but she was just over 100 years old, and she was one of the most well-known, sort of well-read, highly regarded hadith transmitters, female hadith transmitters of Morocco. And so the tradition is very much alive and it continues. So what I want to do now in the time that I have left, about 10 minutes or so, is transition to a case study. And this case study kind of allows me to share with you some of what I learned from a very different historical period, right? When we think about what women are doing when they're learning hadith, when they're transmitting hadith, it looks different in that world. And of course, that's what we should expect, sort of 15th and 16th century or 10th century Cairo, right? But what does that look like? And what I have here on the screen is actually what's known as a biographical entry from one of the classical Arabic sources dealing with 14th and 15th centuries scholars, both male and female. And here's the entry on Zainab bint al-Kamal, and that's the case study that I'm gonna look at for the next few minutes. And I wanna just give you a few minutes to kind of look at this entry and see if you can make any sense of it. And it's a great exercise to do because it gives you a window into the kinds of sources that historians have to deal with when they are piecing together this very fragmentary history of Muslim women. So I'll let you read it, and then I will talk a little bit about her life and why it's significant and kind of place it within the broader context of her time period. So please go ahead and read it, and I will get a sip of water while you're doing that. So let me talk about this a little bit and talk about Zainab's life. If you are anything like I was when I was in the early years of my grad school, you and first encountering this material, you probably can't make much sense of it, right? There's some years, these are Hijri years, and there are a whole lot of names. We don't have the biography from sort of her birth to her death. It doesn't fit the standard form biographies that we know or that we expect when we pick up a biography. And so I came across hundreds of these. And initially I just didn't know what to do with them. Eventually I figured out a methodology of how we can piece together a life story from these. And that's what I'm going to present. So Zainab's story, Zainab bint al-Kamal's story actually begins in 1249 CE. And it begins in, at least for our purposes or for my purposes, in the city of Damascus when she was a one-year-old girl. And when she was that young, she was brought into the presence of a very famous teacher of hadith. And that teacher's name was An-Nishtibri. And I don't think he's mentioned here, but that was actually, he is mentioned actually in the, about halfway down in the entry. And at the time of this encounter, that is when she was brought as a one-year-old girl, An-Nishtibri, it said, was 107 years old, right? So a one-year-old girl before she can probably speak, read or write, being brought into the presence of this very elderly sheikh. And what we think happened at that meeting, or what I think happened at that meeting on the basis of my sources, is that this elder, the father of this young girl, asked the elderly Sheikh An-Nishtibri to authorize this child to transmit all of the sayings that he knew of Prophet Muhammad that he had learned in his entire life, to authorize Zainab to learn them and to be an authoritative teacher of these hadith later in her life. Now, of course, to us, this encounter seems very strange, right? We say, how can a one-year-old, again, obviously before she's speaking, before she's reading and writing, receive authority to transmit all of the knowledge of a 107-year-old sheikh? But What became very clear to me, and what's so interesting about this, is that these kinds of encounters were commonplace across the classical Muslim world. They were about as ordinary as the act of enrolling a child in preschool. That's a very, very commonplace thing that we do today. It's very ordinary. And eventually, Zainab would grow to become one of the most respected hadith transmitters of her time. And, you know, as I said, I want to spend a little bit of time with her career and talking about it. But one of the reasons that I've chosen her case amongst the thousands that I could choose is certainly because it's intriguing, but also because it represents the journey of numerous Muslim women from the 13th to the 15th century. So it is typical, and that's what makes it so interesting. And when I say typical, I mean, I'm showing here a map of, this is from Muhammad Akram Nadwi's book, Muhaddithat, which is another wonderful book on female hadith transmission. But you see here that there are a lot of dots marking the urban centers across the Muslim world. And each one of these was a center for women's hadith learning during these centuries. And so you can see that this practice existed from Al-Andalus all the way in the West to you know, South Asia, to Delhi, Lahore, in the East. So it is a prevalent phenomenon. And again, it's something that it's a phenomenon that we see spanning a few centuries. So Zainab's story is useful because it allows us a window onto the world of hundreds or thousands of women in centuries past. Now, Zainab lived from around 1248 to 1339. And one of the reasons that historians, that is Muslim historians, the Arab chroniclers, are interested in her is because she compiled so many certificates of hadith transmission. There's one biographer, the same one whose biography I translated and had up on the slide. He said that at the time of her death, she possessed a whole entire camel load of ijazas. These ijazas are certificates that list the works that she transmitted and who gave her the authority to transmit those works. So that is a whole lot of ijazas. Now, aside from these kinds of anecdotes that we see, that she had a camel load of ijazas, or that she was brought into the presence of this person or that person when she was very young, as I said earlier, the biographical sources don't give us a complete sketch of her life. So I've had to piece this biography together from a number of sources. And one of the things that we know is that she lived during an era that's known as the Mamluk period in Islamic history, and that spans around the mid 13th century to the 16th century, or in the areas of Egypt and Damascus, I'm sorry, Egypt and Syria, and I think I have a map of this, of the Mamluk Empire and the area that it spanned from the 13th to the early 16th century. And the Mamluks themselves, they were a Turkish dynasty, but they were known for promoting an ideology that we now call Sunni traditionalism. And hadith transmission was an incredibly important part of this ideology and part of the educational system that they promoted. And it was considered, as it is now, one of the best ways that we show respect for the Prophet, right? We learn his hadith and we try to be close to the Prophet by learning the hadith through isnads that are sound and that are ideally not too long. And that's something that we may not be familiar with here in the 21st century, but that was very much a concern for 14th, 15th century and earlier for Muslims in those times. That
can
when
you
they
define
learned,
isnad?
Isnad, that's right. I'm sorry, did you ask me to define it?
Yes, please.
Okay, yeah. Thank you for catching that. So an isnad is actually the chain of transmission that's connected to the text of every hadith, right? So generally an isnad will take you from the time of the Prophet Muhammad or one of his companions all the way up to perhaps the compiler of a work. Right. So, and it basically documents all of the people who transmitted that hadith or that text. So when in Zainab's time, one of the social values was that you wanted to collect hadith with strong isnads, right, with reliable transmitters and short isnads. Right, you didn't want too many people in the chain between yourself and Prophet Muhammad. And that's a very particular social feature of hadith learning in the time, and I don't want to get into it too much here, but maybe we can come back to it in the Q&A. So, I mean, the reason that I bring all of this up is that it's important to understand this broader context of the promotion of hadith learning during the Mamluk period. So the Mamluks really reinforced and disseminated what, again, I refer to as traditionalist Islam throughout all of the lands that they controlled in Egypt and Syria. They endowed schools, some of the most beautiful schools, like architecturally speaking, in Syria and Damascus, that exist today, even today, were built and endowed by the Mamluks. They did the same for mosques. They paid for stipends for teachers and students, all of whom would ultimately promote this ideology. And this background is really relevant to understanding women's education, because even though women themselves may not have taught in those schools or may not have attended those schools as students, in fact, we don't have too many records of women who taught in those schools or attended them as students, what it did was create a broader environment of teachers and students coming through the areas where women like Zainab lived, and they interacted with them outside of schools. And so it proved to be a benefit to women's education, broadly speaking, that is Mamluk investment in hadith learning. And Zainab herself lived in an area that's outside of Damascus known as As-Salihiyya. And women were so active in this area that a modern historian has called As-Salihiyya a hub or an urban center that was the center of women's scholarly activity across the Muslim world in her time. And so keeping that sort of very broad political and social background in mind, what I want to do is talk a little bit more about the specifics of Zainab's career that I find so interesting. So I said that she received certification at the age of one from Anishtibri. She was awarded a whole bunch of other certificates at a very, very young age from other sheikhas and shuyukh. And I won't list some of those names here. They were in the biography. But what's interesting about them is that they came from, or they were, their origins are from cities all over the Muslim world. They were from Aleppo, Haran, Alexandria, Cairo, a number of other cities in Syria. And so what these contacts do is tie her into a very extensive network of learning that stretched across the Muslim world. So here's another map that actually maps the journeys and learning network of a woman named Fatima bin Saad al-Khair. And you can see how, you know, through this network, she was connected to scholars all over the Muslim world. I mean, this was not, even though this is very much before the age of modern communication and transportation, these women and male scholars did not live in isolated, sealed off worlds of learning. So because, you know, we know that Zainab's career began at a very, very young age, we assume that there was an intermediary who paved the way for her. And this is actually a very important feature of women's education. It's the ways in which family networks are critical to establishing their success. In Zainab's case, it's her father who solicited all these certificates for her, who brought her to the assemblies of sheikhs to acquire certificates for her, and who also probably taught her the rudiments of Islam from a very, very young age. Now what's, again, different and interesting about the early sources is Most of them are, of course, written by male scholars, as Adina pointed out earlier, and most of them are really not interested in how the culture of domesticity, right, how women's marriage or childbearing or these kinds of things might have affected their career. And so nobody really tells us about what Zainab's private life was like in that regard. But what we do know is that she never married and she didn't have children, of course. And so I imagine that being single and not having children probably allowed her to devote a lot of time to her studies and was probably accounts in some ways for some of the tremendous success that she had. Now, a few more features of her career. We know from all of these ijazas that she received that her authority was to transmit works wasn't just limited to the Sunni collections, right? The Sahih of Bukhari or Muslim or all the other major Sunni collections, although that was an important part of her repertoire. She could transmit works related to Sufism or ascetic piety, to tafsir, to Islamic law. So her range was extensive. And there's one scholar who said that Zainab gave him certificates to transmit around 150 works in all different genres of Islamic learning. So really her range was very broad. And I'm sure that that in part accounted for her success. Another thing that I found interesting about her career is that she held hadith assemblies. She didn't just teach students one-on-one. And her assemblies, it seems, were often open to the general public. So what we see in the sources is that she held classes in locations like mosques in her area, in private homes, in gardens even, in the homes of her students. And I was very happy that when I went to Syria back in 2010, I was actually able to visit one of the mosques where it said that she held some of her lessons. This is Jami' al-Hanabila in As-Salihiyya, Syria. And at least one of the certificates mentions an assembly that she held in this mosque. And she, I think in that particular certificate, she convened the assembly when she was around 75 years old. And she may have had over 100 students who learned from her in that one particular assembly. So what's interesting again about the trajectory of Zainab's life is that what the historical sources show us is that she was very active when she was young and she was also active when she was very old. In fact, most of the sources depict her as teaching when she was between the ages of 70 and into her 90s, right? So it's a really, really remarkable kind of life trajectory, and unusual sort of time, windows of activity that the historical sources capture for us. And I see that I'm running out of time. I promised Adina I'd speak for about 25 minutes. So I wanna just conclude with a few comments, and maybe we can come back to some of the points that I wanted to make in the Q&A. The general observations. I just said that the sources are male authored, right? And they focus on men's history. So it's very, very easy in these, when you're looking at these types of sources, to overlook the history of women, especially when the historical sources or the biographies look like this, right? I mean, they're very cryptic, they're fragmentary, it's hard to make sense of them. But what they show when you sit with them patiently and you try to piece them together is that women were indeed incredibly active, and they participated, and they participated publicly. And we can't properly understand Muslim society and Muslim history in all of its breadth and depth unless we sit patiently with the sources. And we really try to account for the worlds of both men and women. And I really hope that this talk prompts some of you, especially those of you who might be embarking on your own careers, academic careers, to turn to this area of learning or historical research. And the second sort of concluding point that I wanna make is that it's amazing to me as a historian who's kind of immersed in this history of women's learning, that the subject of whether women can acquire an education, a religious education, whether they should, is still a hotly debated one. It's contested, right? It's contested among Muslims and non-Muslims. It's unfortunately contested because we see, in our contemporary world, sort of phenomenon such as what's happening in Afghanistan with the Taliban a few years ago, shutting down all the schools for women and girls. So there's still a lot of misunderstanding about this topic. And I do think that learning about the history of Muslim women like Zainab bint al-Kamal, who participated publicly and very actively in shaping their social and intellectual worlds, and help us rethink some of these issues that are so contentious in the modern world or in our contemporary times. So I'll end there, and thank you for your attention.
That was wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Asma.
Thank you.
I am already brimming with questions, and I want to give priority to, we have one question so far in the chat box, and that's a straightforward one, which is, please define the Ottoman era.
Okay. that is the time. Yes, I mean, that's basically the time period when a dynasty called the Ottomans, they were called the Ottomans, ruled primarily in the area of, it's Turkey today, but Anatolia, in Syria. Their reach was extensive. They ruled across North Africa and across the Middle East. Great. So from about the mid 16th century to the early 20th century. And I'm actually going to stop sharing my screen.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, great. Well, I invite everyone else who is tuned in with us to put your questions into the chat box in all caps. And I'm going to use this opportunity to ask a couple of my own questions. In reading your book, I kept picturing a roller coaster with these ups and downs in the trajectory of women in their prominence and recognition of their hadith transmission. And am I getting this right? That there were obviously within the wives of the Prophet and the companion generation, there was participation. Within 100 years of the Prophet's death, peace be upon him, the women's participation as hadith transmitters quickly tanked. And then it took three more centuries, about until the fourth century after Hijra, for women to, or fifth century actually, for women to reemerge on the scene. And this was after the professionalization of the hadith sciences that sort of excluded women because of the higher standards that you indicated. And then by the fifth century, or was that a fourth century or fifth century that it went down and then back up?
Yeah. Fourth and fifth century, and sixth century, there's a real flourishing, a remarkable increase, yeah.
And that flourishing, I'm going to come back to in a moment, because we see that flourishing then, and the emergence of more scholars by the 10th century, and then things tank again by the 15th century with the early Ottomans. And so again, I picture, this fluctuation that's taking place. And so now I want to circle back to that question of women's reemergence, especially after the professionalization of the hadith science. And I want to go in two directions with this, because one is that the question of why women's scholarship was limited to the role of hadith transmission. Because that's one of the main things that I got from your book, is that besides Aisha, the wife of Prophet Muhammad and the daughter of Abu Bakr, and Salama, who was one of the wives, who had some authority with regard to being able to, well, Aisha, I guess, had more interpretation authority as she talked about hadith. But all the other scholars, if I read your book correctly, until about the 10th century after Hijra, are primarily in the realm of hadith transmission, which is regurgitating knowledge rather than interpretation or the fiqh side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, this is something that that I've also struggled with. And initially, there are a number of things going on here, and I'll try to unpack them. One is that we have to think about the nature of our sources. Right. And so the nature of our sources is that this genre of biography was primarily devoted to hadith. Well, no, actually, I mean, it's hadith transmission and other fields of learning as well, but with a greater focus on hadith transmission. So it's when we look at the men as well, I mean, there is a preponderance of male hadith transmitters too. So there is this interest in this genre of sources in hadith transmission, broadly speaking. The other thing is that, yes, I mean, what I'm not suggesting here is that the sources conceal hundreds or thousands of women who were, you know, known for fiqh or tafsir or other types of engagement. I don't think they do. I do think that that is an area in which women just didn't have opportunities and weren't as engaged. And I don't think that it's because women were prevented from some like sort of misogynistic place in or an anti-woman place in participating. I really do think it has to do with the fact that women just didn't have opportunities to have exposure to that type of education, mm-hmm. or to be inculcated into those educational tracks. Hadith lent itself to the life cycles, the cycles of domesticity that women experienced and continue to experience today. It was a field in which women sort of could participate because of the types of skills that it required. Mm-hmm. It allowed women the space to kind of memorize works and then reproduce them, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, so the part that I struggle with is that, I mean, I hear you when you say, okay, it's not fiqh and it's not tafsir, right? And so, and what you're not saying, but what I think the subtext is there, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that somehow it may be less, right?
I mean, to your point, is it a matter of erasure, right? Who's telling the story? So women were valued as hadith transmitters. So their value was centered, right?
Yes.
And as you, I mean, you, as you indicate, there women may have participated in other areas, and that's maybe one of my, you know, the additional blind spots. Wasn't it hadith transmission that classified them as scholars throughout the centuries in traditional Sunni Islam? I mean, that's one of the core arguments I'm getting from your book, is that it was hadith transmission,
yes,
that
made them
qualify as scholars, like the other types of activity that they did with regard to religion, right? That didn't qualify them as scholars per se. It perhaps qualified them instead as teachers or preachers.
Oh, no. There are some women, far fewer in number, who were known for their knowledge of fiqh, right? Who are known as faqihas. Some women who are known for engaging with the Quran. So, but that also qualified them as authorities. What I think is really tricky about this is the ways in which we understand those cultures and let them speak for their time. So in our culture, right, what's interesting, what's fascinating, and what's a mark of authority is that you engage with a text and you write your own book, right? If I were just to be proficient in memorizing and reproducing the works of others, that is orally, that doesn't count for as much in our culture. Mm-hmm. And so I guess what I'm trying to do as a historian, as an academic who's sort of passionate about understanding cultures for their own times, is say, let's see what these women's authority represented in their own time, right? Yes. They were valuable, they were valued, they were respected. And that, I think, counts for quite a lot.
It sure does. Yeah, thank you for that. Okay, I'm going to turn over to the questions that are coming in. I see three or four of them here. So the first one is, are there any female hadith transmitters today?
Yes, there are. And I mentioned one in my in the initial comments that I made, Sheikha Bahia in Morocco. She passed away recently, but again, her life is very much in the mold of these earlier female hadith transmitters, in which she is known for memorizing works, having great chains of isnads, great chains of transmission, and faithfully memorizing the works. There's a different phenomenon nowadays, which is not just hadith transmission, but women engaging with hadith scholarship, right? So, looking at whether, for example, all the hadith that have to do with women, what are those hadith? What kinds of pictures do they portray? Are they hadith that support women's accomplishments? Are they hadith that somehow limit what women? I don't say the hadith don't limit what women can do, but the hadith are worded in a way that is demeaning or deprecating of women. What do they tell us about the time of the prophet and the centuries afterwards? So there's a lot more engagement by women with the content of the hadith itself and critical engagement.
Thank you. Okay, next question comes from last week's guest, Gail Kennard, who says, would women have had access to education in the Mamluk times you discussed?
Yes. So access to religious education, I'm assuming, is what's being discussed or what the question is about. And yes, absolutely. I mean, that's, I think Zainab bint Kamal is a prime example of that, that she did have access to education and to, to reading different genres. So whether that's history, biography, Sufism, law, I mean, she knew works in all of those genres. And so they did have access. The question is how much access? I mean, how many women actually had that access, and to what extent you had to have a family network that opened the doors for you. We don't know. I mean, literacy, it was not widespread in that time period among men and women, and both men and women needed family networks to introduce them to other scholars and to education.
And to that, so I want to piggyback a question on that, because that's another theme that came up in your book, was again around the power of the family that you're born into, that becoming a female scholar of any regard largely relied on the family that you were born into, and whether your father himself was a scholar of, and had access. And in the case of, what is the name of the woman who, as a 1-year-old, sat with
Zainab.
And so being able to have that kind of access, that it struck me as one of the paradoxes that it was the professionalization of the hadith sciences in the within the first few centuries of Islam that first kind of excluded women from having access to this parameter. But then later on, now we're in the 5th century after Hijra, where the professionalization of the ulama class, which is the class of scholars, produced this importance of ulama families, right? That there was this question of lineage of the scholars that you came from, and also the scholars that you produced. And so I forget it may also be Zainab, but I forget the name of the scholar who it's said that she produced scholars for 7 generations beyond.
Fatima.
Thank you.
The daughter of, Bint Ali.
And so again, one of these paradoxes is that, that the professionalization again first excludes women, and then later being able to have this other kind of professionalization of ulema meant that having women scholars within your family of scholars improved your lot as an ulema family and your usefulness to whoever the power, the regime was, essentially, or the dynasties that were in charge. And so all of these things played a role. And so to me, I think again about how women always played a useful role, right? And they were uplifted or pulled back or retracted or expanded depending on their usefulness within the societal context. And that continues to be the case. I'm not sharing, too eye-opening, but it is, as is true throughout history, the fate of women scholars follows, the whatever is going on in society at that time. And that women needed to be part of a family chain in order to have a chance at becoming a scholar. Because as you said, they weren't part of the madrasa system. And that's something that struck me about a lot of these women, was that they They learned outside of the madrasa system, and that they spent their, you might say, their childbearing years. So while they were exalted as children gaining hadith, and they were also exalted as teachers in their postmenopausal years, from my reading of your book, it seems that they were not absent, but that's what occurred to me in reading it, is absent during their, what you might consider their childbearing years. So I don't know that there's a question necessarily embedded there, but I see a lot about the family connections and about age and about the kind of women that that were, you know, that were valued and had opportunities for scholarship.
Absolutely. I mean, I have to say that I am so happy, you know, that you got that point from my book, that professionalization, for example, works in different ways, right? It worked in different ways in the early periods, and then it works in different ways from like the 6th century onwards. And that's, I mean, for me, it was a key point of my book, but I wasn't really sure if anybody could get that, because I do know that it's dense and historical. So thank you. That was very reaffirming for me that you got that. And the reason for that is that what I really try to do is discourage all of us, right, from facile, like simplistic readings of history and of our time period too. And we see a social or economic factor, and we should be careful from reading it in a particular way across history. Like, we shouldn't think, okay, professionalization necessarily excludes women from, you know, X, Y, and Z spheres of accomplishments. It does at one point for hadith, but then later, that is precisely the reason why the doors are open for women in very interesting ways. So, you know, I really would encourage us to be sensitive to those things, not just in history, but in our own times, right? I mean, how is it that, setting aside feminism, setting aside women's empowerment and all those things, how is it that the socioeconomic factors of our time, how are they promoting certain types of changes in our society that perhaps subconsciously or unintentionally are either benefiting women or harming them? Now, case in point, right? I mean, something that is so interesting for me. So when we, one of the courses I teach at UCLA is on Islam in America. And I'm really fascinated by the Nation of Islam and you know, African American Islam in urban centers. And I mean, one of the things that I've noticed is that, you know, with the rise of the Nation of Islam, there are, you know, there are different types of critiques or engagements with it when it comes to the place of woman within that group. And some people say, okay, the Nation of Islam like introduced this very patriarchal, a highly structured family structure in which, you know, patriarchy was considered the norm, it was valued. And you know, it gave women a very constricted role. But the other thing that you see with the Nation of Islam is that it gave women a lot of leadership opportunities. I mean, we see this in Southern California as well with the number of women in the Nation of Islam and African American mosques who are given positions of leadership in different ways, in ways that are remarkably different, I think, than what we see in immigrant communities as well. So I want us to be really careful about how we read these socioeconomic factors and not think of them as unitary, and be able to examine them in very micro community circumstances, whether we're talking about early Islamic history or the present. And if I could just make one other point, Dina, to your point about how women were excluded or included in different times. I would like us to be cautious about just seeing women as kind of puppets who are moved around depending on, you know, whether something is being professionalized or not, or what's happening with the ulama classes. What I got a sense of in reading all of these biographies, even though the women themselves are not speaking here, is a sense of spiritual fulfillment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is no doubt for me after reading, you know, thousands of these biographies, that this was an avenue for spiritual fulfillment for these women. They were respected and they gained something from their participation here. And I don't ever want to lose sight of that as well.
Thank you for that. And I definitely need to be challenged. I remind myself first. So that's very helpful. Okay, so back to the questions from our participants. One person here asks, please, oh, this is a big one. Please share with us the most important lesson to be learned from your research, aside that women were involved and an integral part of Hadith transmission. In other words, did their involvement have a profound impact on their societies that is different from current times?
That's a very good question. And it's a good question because, you know, what it does is it forces me to define or forces me to think about what profound impact means. And okay, so I would say yes, in the sense that they modeled a type of spirituality and behavior for both that was considered valuable for both men and women, right? And they modeled an avenue towards, as I was just saying, spiritual fulfillment in which they were participants. They were clearly out in the public domain modeling this behavior. And they were important in preserving the legacy of the Prophet and preserving historical sources well after the time of the Prophet. Now, you know, I think sometimes in our societies, we equate profound impact with radical change. Mm. And that's, I wouldn't say that that's true of these women, right? These were not women who are looking to subvert the dominant order. They weren't looking in some of the ways that we do to question the bases and the sources of authority and say, this is totally wrong. You know, they acquired their authority by upholding the power structures that existed, at least as far as religious education is concerned. So, but profound impact, I think, yes, because they continue to model behavior for women's participation. But no, and you know, according to some of the other things that we have on our checklist today.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay, next question is, in your opinion, do you think that the Muslim women scholars have been marginalized in the history of Islam?
In raw numbers, yes. I mean, if we look at there's no denying that if the historical sources are an actual reflection of what was happening on the ground, and you know, there's such a few percentage of them that actually make it to those sources, there's no doubt that there's marginalization existing across Islamic history all the way up to the present. I mean, we're not, you know, we haven't conquered those battles by any means. And I don't want to sort of divert attention from the issue of marginalization, but I do think that it's important to also think about, okay, yes, they were marginalized, but what were the reasons that they were marginalized? And the reasons are primarily ones having to do with intellectual history and social history and economic history or material history. They're not theological reasons. They're not doctrinal reasons. So I did not come across any source, you know, in my readings, it says women were prohibited, women should never do this. Because it's not, it's against their nature as women, right? Mm. Or it's something that Islam doesn't allow, you know, for a woman to have literacy in terms of religious education. So that to me, it was also important. So understanding the reasons for that marginalization, not minimizing them, but then if we really want to take many steps forward in our day and age, understanding those and then saying, how can we deal with those? With those mm-hmm.
Excellent, okay. This person says, this is more of a comment I'd love to hear you expound upon. I understand from the language of the first text you presented that Zainab did a great deal of listening to both teachers and students. To me, that speaks to the mark of an effective educator in Islam or otherwise.
Yes, although, you know, the listening, again, it's a different world. Right. And so that we're talking about when we're talking about her lifetime, 13th, 14th century. So she's doing listening, but what she's listening to is texts that others are reciting to her to ascertain their authenticity. Mm-hmm. It's not the same type of listening that is necessarily, that is valued, you know, in pedagogy. And so what she was doing fulfilled the role that she had for her time and place. This was in the eras before print, where the way in which you faithfully reproduce works by was by copying them and then by reciting them to respected teachers to make sure that you got it right. And so, yes, I agree that she was a good listener, but perhaps not exactly in the sense that we think of it today.
Mm-hmm. So this question is probably to me more so, which is, are you including women scholars from Shia Islam? And I think the person adds in your book. To be clear, your book focuses on Sunni Islam. Maybe you can, could you expand on this idea and whether what you do know about the Shia women scholarship and where your own choices were in your research?
Yes, absolutely. So you're absolutely, the work deals with Sunni Islam, almost entirely. And part of the reason for that is just that my choices were in part dictated by my sources. The biographical material that I'm dealing with is kind of split in some ways along a sectarian divide for much of Islamic history. And I did, after this book was written, I did look at the Shi'i material and actually have an article on that. It's called Woman and Imami Biographical Collection. So I look at 12 or Shi'ism and trace what's happening with Shi'i women there. And it's a very different story there because Hadith transmission actually for much of Shi'i history, intellectual history, doesn't play the same role that it did in Sunni Islam. So we just don't have that many female Shi'i Hadith transmitters. And I kind of, in my article, talk about the sort of intellectual history reasons for that. They play different types of roles that are documented in the Shi'i historical sources.
Thank you for that. And also to this question, as I mentioned in the beginning, it's my intention to bring a Shi'i woman's voice into this conversation in the coming weeks. And so stay tuned for that because it is a known blind spot in the content that we've put together in this 4-week series. But I have a question in my book, but I'm going to wait because the students come first. Okay, someone cautioned.
Just real quick, before I forget, it just occurred to me that, you know, for those of you who are interested in Shi'i women's religious learning, it is a growing subfield now. And there was actually a conference devoted to this very topic at Princeton about 2 or 3 years ago. I don't know if the conference papers have been published yet, but the book that was coming out of that conference either has recently been published or will soon be published. So if you just, you know, type in Shi'i woman religious learning, I mean, I think it will come up. But there's a lot more work being done on that now. And one of the most interesting figures as far as contemporary Shi'ism is concerned is a woman named Nusrat Amin, who wrote an entire tafsir. She's one of the few women who has a published tafsir on the entire Quran. She's also known for being an alima, a mujtahida in Iran. And there are quite a few studies, relatively speaking, done on her life that I think are very interesting.
That's wonderful. Thank you for bringing additional names into our conversation. If you are able to, in these last few minutes, I meant to do it as we were talking, is to type in the names of the women that we have shared here today. If people want to, you know, Google or look for more information, it would be great to provide that list and also provide it on the Facebook comments as well. I can go back and collect them myself and ask my, we can do it together. It would be great because, you know, we centering these women's names and having access to them is so powerful, and it gives us access to our legacy and also to our context. And in that regard, maybe a good last question is going back to that issue of marginalization as you recognize. Well, so let me do this first. So somebody pointed out that we should be, the person says, I know you didn't make stereotypes out of the Nation of Islam, and we should be careful to characterize the Nation of Islam in one particular way. And I want to recognize that comment. And so then the last question is, somebody asks, how do you think we can deal with those reasons for marginalization of women? And she says, as you said, not to minimalize, but to use it to deal with the reason. Yeah. So how do you think we can deal with those reasons for the marginalization of women?
Yes. So just, you know, quickly going back to you said about stereotypes in the Nation of Islam, I hope no one came away from what I said with the thought that I had any intention of stereotyping the history of that group. I mean, I find it extraordinary, complex, and really, really interesting for studying some of the issues, salient issues, as far as Islam in America is concerned. And I absolutely would encourage everybody to move away from any of the stereotypes and to look at that very rich history for what it is and for what it can offer us in so many ways. And with respect to marginalization, you know, again, I think that understanding socioeconomic factors at play is so important. I mean, just moving, I'm not opposed at all to feminism or feminist discourses. I mean, I find them also fascinating in very interesting ways, and I've tapped into it in very interesting ways in my own work. But when I look at a contemporary case like Morocco, for example, which is where I'm doing my field work now, some of the most interesting, accomplished women that I've encountered in the domain of religious education, I mean, leading authorities, I'm speaking of in Morocco, like, for example, I'm writing an article right now on a woman who is a Quranic studies professor in one of the leading institutions in Morocco. You know, there are socioeconomic forces that are responsible, that helped explain her rise and her authority and how she got where she gets. And she herself doesn't position herself within the discourses of feminism or a woman's marginalization or exclusion. And so I think looking, you know, at all these other spheres in addition to that, understanding how it is that a government initiative in education may ultimately open up spaces for women and their religious education in unintended ways sometimes, right? And the other thing that I would really like us to think about, and I hope there are men in the audience here as well, and not just women, but we all take in the authority of women very differently from how we take in the authority of men. And I think that in very, very large part, at least in contemporary societies, helps to account for some of this marginalization that we're seeing, right? I mean, how often are our panels embracing of both women's perspectives and men's perspectives? And when they do include women, how often do we just dismiss it as, okay, well, you know, she's coming to that place because she's coming from a place where she's a woman, right? And how do we conceive of their authority in very different ways? I mean, I honestly get that so much as a female professor of Islamic studies, where I think people would like to peg me a certain way because I'm a woman and because I'm, you know, South Asian and I'm teaching Islam in particular ways. And I would say just set all that aside and try to understand what people are saying for the substance of their words rather than whether they're coming to it as a South Asian or a woman or a man. And I think that will help to confront for us to confront some of these problems in more head-on ways.
Thank you. Well, that gives us a great place to pause our conversation because we're almost out of time. This has been really, really extraordinary to be able to get these themes over 10 centuries. And thank you for your scholarship. Thank you for shining a light for us on so many hidden areas and for challenging our own assumptions and my assumptions, particularly. This has been a really great conversation. I want to encourage people, again, if you want to dig deeper, you sold it as a very academic read. I found it very digestible. Islamic content is not always, is not always relatable and digestible, but I highly recommend this book, and it is called Women in the Transmission of Religious Knowledge in Islam, and you can get it on the usual places classes online, and hopefully support your local bookstores and independent bookstores. It's just 200 pages. The access to more and more names is a good place for us to end in knowing the names of these women scholars, so that we add to the history and to the storytelling around this aspect of the legacies that we have inherited as Muslim women and as Muslim men. Something that stood out to me among the many figures that you captured is that they had both male and female students, and often that their male students outweighed the number of female students that they had. Yes. And that these barriers around co-educational environments was not a barrier for the learned women, that does speak to the legacy of Prophet Muhammad and the very seed of Islam that was planted through the Quran, that was able to stay present throughout all the strife.
Yes,
and the roller coaster.
I completely agree with you. Yeah. Thank you for highlighting that. I appreciate
absolutely.
It.
So from here, where we go next is next week. We will be joined by Angelica Lindsay Ali, who has conducted research into Muslim women scholars in West Africa, and will bring us a broader picture. Dr. Saeed's work, if I remember correctly, extended from Egypt to Iran in its geographical scope. And so the intention is to expand into other geographical scopes. And again, we will do what we can with the time that we have available. I'm really enjoying this so much so far. And I want to thank everybody for joining us. Dr. Saeed, you're welcome to stay with us or leave. We will conclude with our closing dua, just to put a seal on this experience with all of us. And are you comfortable sharing an email address or a Twitter handle or anything if people have?
I actually do not have a Twitter handle, and nor do I wish I had a Twitter handle, but I do have an email that is, if you just Google me, my UCLA email will come up, and you're welcome. Anybody is welcome to email me there. I will stay on, but I will turn off my video for the dua and do my dua in private. So I just wanted to thank everyone again for being a part of this. It's, as I said, really gratifying for me to be able to share my research with a broader audience. So thank you. And thank you again, Adina, for having me on this.
Thank you. Yeah.